As you likely know, two people were killed last night in an attack. A young man was caught on cell phone video, apparently opening fire in the middle of the street in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And police in a city about 15 miles from Kenosha in the town of Antioch have released a youth under the age of 18, so his name has not been released. He has been arrested on suspicion of first-degree intentional homicide. This a result of last night's shooting and the deaths of two individuals who were out in the streets during the protests and the disturbances that were taking place in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which have gone on several nights there after the police shooting and serious injuring of an African-American man. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Larry Mantle, to talk about Women's Equality Day. And this centennial year of the passing of the 19th Amendment, its ratification, and women's suffrage. Joining us to talk about the historical importance of this year and also to analyze where women are at in political representation today is Rutgers University Camden Associate Professor of Political Science, Kelly Dittmar, also Director of Research at Rutgers Center for American Women and Politics. Professor Dittmar, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start, first of all, with the significance of Women's Equality Day, an annual event, but particularly this year, the centennial year of the 19th.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is a really important moment for reflection because it allows us to look at what has been accomplished in terms of the advancement of women's political rights and equity, but also reflect on the underlying problems and continued hurdles to women's political participation. So thankfully, I think we've seen a lot more interrogation of, for example, the racism within the suffrage movement, as well as the fact that for many women, the right to vote has not been seen for 100 years. It's been far less. And so I think this is a good moment. And while we celebrate, you know, the passage of this amendment, to also reflect on all of the work that's left to do to be sure that women's political voices are heard and equally heard in our political systems.
If I'm not mistaken, maybe you can clarify, California enfranchised women's vote before the 19th Amendment was ratified, as I understand.
Yeah, I believe it's most states had some version of enfranchisement for women. Of course, there were still restrictions and it depended on the state, other restrictions on voting perhaps, but many states were starting to move in this direction because the suffrage activists and organizations were working on two fronts, right? So they were looking at a state-by-state strategy in which they would try to pass a similar amendment within state constitutions, while also advocating for a federal amendment to provide or at least prevent denying the right to vote on the basis of sex, which is ultimately the 19th Amendment.
Professor Kelly Dittmar of Rutgers University Camden in New Jersey. Also with us is Associate Professor of Political Science, Nadia E. Brown of Purdue University. She's also Associate Professor of African American Studies. Professor Brown, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Let's talk a bit about the representation of non-white women within the movement. I thought I had heard that there were African-American women who were working on the vote, but were not often included in the larger group. Is that true?
Yes, that's accurate. And much of this goes back to Kelly's comment around the systemic racism within the suffrage movement, right? And there are countless numbers of Black women who have fought for suffrage, from Sojourner Truth to Harriet Tubman, people that we know their names and we recite them in other places, but we don't talk about their role in women's suffrage. And this underscores the prevalence of racism as a strategy to woo over Southern white women and white men who were reluctant to see suffrage as something that should be had for all or particularly white women. So the suffrage leaders made a concerted effort to disenfranchise and silence Black women as a way to try to sway white Southerners over to their side.
Was there an attempt to assuage concerns that this would open up the door for African-American voting, that, well, if women are allowed to vote, then African-Americans might be allowed to vote, and that so that women in this in the larger suffrage movement had to confront that racism?
Sure. So, right, the 15th Amendment is passed prior to the 19th Amendment, obviously, which gave universal Black male suffrage, right, opened up suffrage to men and particularly Black men. But we know that effectively that didn't happen until 1965 Voting Rights Act, which made illegal all of the systematic barriers to voting based on race. So it wasn't so much of a concern that Black people would be able to vote because many places Black people were effectively barred from the vote, but it was a racist appeal to saying if white women are allowed to vote, they will be a double vote, basically casting off the votes that would have been cast by Black people. So extending the suffrage to women would make them equal to their husbands and would give an extra vote of that household to kind of cancel out the votes of Black Americans who were not seen as full citizens, as human, as worthy of participation in the electoral system.
We're talking with Purdue University Professor Nadia E. Brown and Rutgers University Camden Professor Kelly Dittmar. Coming up, we'll talk about the representation of women in American political life today. We, of course, know that women decide elections. They're in the majority of voters and carry that clout. But what about in elective office, the halls of power themselves? We're at 866-893-KPCC. If you have questions of our expert guests on this Women's Equality Day, we'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. A reminder, tonight at 6 o'clock, it's NPR's live coverage of the Republican National Convention, Night 3. Vice President Pence is going to be speaking. Tomorrow night, the convention closes out. President Trump will be the final speaker from the White House, quite controversially. The next two nights of the RNC Live with NPR's coverage and analysis, 6 o'clock right here on 89.3 KPCC. It's Women's Equality Day and, of course, the centennial year of the ratification and enactment of the 19th Amendment, enfranchising women's votes here in the United States. We're talking with our guests, scholars Kelly Dittmar of Rutgers University Camden and Nadia Brown of Purdue University in Indiana. Professor Dittmar, as we look over the past couple of decades of women holding higher office, what does the trend appear to be on the percentages of women elected?
Yeah, I think we have a similar story, as I was saying before, about we can celebrate progress and also note so much progress left to make. So we had seen relatively stagnant growth, at least incremental, I guess is a better word for it, over the last couple of decades in women's representation in political office, meaning we were making small gains pretty consistently. And of course, there are some differences by party. But what we saw in 2018 was a record number of Democratic women running and winning across levels of office that gave us some steeper gains for any single election cycle. But even after that record year of women, we are still at about 23.7% of women in Congress. Women are 28.9% of statewide executive office holders and 29.2% of state legislators across the country. So it's a good reminder that as much progress as we have made, which is significant and notable in so many ways and important to the substance of governance, we also have a lot of room to grow to get closer to gender parity, which would be women at or slightly over 50% of our representatives at all of these levels of office. And of course, there are real partisan disparities that have grown in recent years where Democratic women really dominate among this these office holding numbers, and Republican women have actually seen some decline, and they're trying to remedy that this year, running in record numbers for the U.S. House.
Oddly, here in California, a progressive state that's had two U.S. senators for many years now that are women, we still have not had a woman governor in California. Professor Brown, your assessment of where we're at in women's representation.
Yeah, so I feel like I'm just going to echo Kelly's comments. But yeah, they're the same. The numbers tell us a very important story, and adding other politically salient identities magnify these issues. So there have been very few women of color elected at statewide offices. You mentioned California. We know that women have some difficulty in winning outside of multi-member districts for legislative purposes, and that having a woman executive is a pretty hard feat, right? So it's still, we're able to count on our hands the number of black women executives. There's been none, no black women governors, but also just women executives are very few. And it's because of winning these majority districts, right? These majority places. So it's not just winning your district, but winning, like I said, the whole state.
All right. You know, as we look at women, you know, winning the governor's office, I mean, it's interesting that a more conservative state like Arizona has had at least two women governors, California none. What are some of the barriers, Professor Brown, do you think, to women holding that office? And I know we've had many more women governors, but certainly it's not parity.
Right. So historically, women have had some difficulties in raising money to mount a successful campaign, getting the attention of one of the major political parties to support them. Women also face stereotypes and discrimination and what voters ascribe to women leaders and their ability to think about women as leaders in political positions. Some of these are due to socialization and gender norms. We also know that women tend to run later in life, mostly after they've done with child rearing. But I think that the tide is changing. Some of these things aren't necessarily handicaps for all women, but they're enough to systematically make it so that women are less likely to run for office and to win elected office.
Professor Brown, thank you so much. Professor Dittmar, we appreciate your being with us. Just Professor Dittmar, real briefly, because I'm closing out the hour here, but the significance of Kamala Harris as the choice of running mate for Joe Biden.
Like, I think across levels of office this year, including at the top of the ticket, what you're looking for is, are the folks on the ballot reflecting the population they serve? And I think at least in the multiple identities that she brings to the ticket, she's challenging the white male dominance that we've seen in American politics.
Thank you both very much. That's Kelly Dittmar, Rutgers University, Camden, and Professor Nadia Brown of Purdue University in Indiana. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, NPR Hourly News have the latest on Hurricane Laura being upgraded to Category 4. Serious concerns along the U.S. Gulf Coast.